Opponents of the new abortion law hope courts will find it an invasion of privacy. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. And Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry talks about the Glacier Institute's alternative energy project. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a University of Montana professor about a study done by a group of cyclists whose record-breaking ride drew some conventional assumptions. Abortion rights advocates are suing the state over a bill passed by the 2013 legislature. The bill requires parental consent before a minor can have an abortion. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says opponents of the new law hope the courts will find it an invasion of privacy.
The abortion consent bill, House Bill 391, passed the legislature on mostly partisan lines. Governor Steve Bullock let the bill pass into law without his signature. He did so with the expectation abortion rights advocates would sue to get the new statute thrown out. And they have. Planned Parenthood of Montana Communications Director Lindsay Love believes the law is clearly unconstitutional.
When it comes to reproductive health care, our statutes, our law books actually grant minors the right to consent for their own health care services.
So she says the law is an invasion of privacy and also equal protection, since minor girls who decide to go through with their pregnancy do not need parental consent for medical services in the law. She says courts tossed out a similar law in the 90s. Opponents of the measure, like Love, say the vast majority of pregnant teenage girls do consult their parents before seeking an abortion. They say the small minority who don't may have worries of parental abuse. Hamilton Republican Representative Nancy Balance was one of the co-sponsors of the consent bill. She is personally against abortion. She believes requiring a parent's okay for a decision that big is the right thing to do for the health of the girl and of the family unit.
Why do we set up a situation where we make it very easy for girls to have indiscriminate sex and then tell them it's all okay, you don't have to tell mommy and daddy?
Balance says parents should have a say in these situations. Parents oftentimes know important medical information that their teenager may not have told her doctor or may not even know about herself. Also, she says minors may not fully grasp the emotional trauma that can come with an abortion.
There are so many women that I talk to who 20, 30 years later still have that in their mind that an abortion was done, that there was a child that they never saw, that they never got to know, and for whatever reason, it is haunting.
Balance agrees there are a small number of cases where a girl would avoid telling her parents about an abortion to avoid abuse. But she says there are other options for those girls to turn to, like counseling services or law enforcement. Montana voters endorsed a similar measure to the consent bill last November. This one only required parents be notified of a child's abortion. It passed with over 70% of the vote. Balance believes the majority of Montanans would also agree with the consent law. Lindsay Love with Planned Parenthood sees it differently.
We don't put fundamental rights up for popular vote. That's why our Constitution exists. And ultimately, that's why we've taken this course.
When the consent bill became law, it superseded the notification rules passed by voters last November. But the lawsuit from Planned Parenthood is actually against both measures, looking for the courts to toss out both as unconstitutional. It's unclear when the state district court will take any action on the suit. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, the Blackfeet Tribe's chief prosecutor says his office is waiting for the results of an investigation before deciding whether to charge a state senator accused of fleeing a law enforcement officer. His prosecutor said today he doesn't know when the probe into Senator Shannon Ogier will be completed, and tribal police have, quote, more serious things to take care of, unquote. He quickly added he wasn't downplaying the allegations against Ogier, who is also a tribal councilman. The Glacier National County Sheriff's Office says Ogier was stopped Sunday for erratic driving on U.S. Highway 2. Authorities say the deputy smelled alcohol and Ogier appeared to be impaired. Ogier allegedly told the deputy he had no jurisdiction to arrest him and drove away. The Sheriff's Office turned the matter over to the tribe.
U.S. Representative Steve Daines says that continued investigation into the Internal Revenue Service targeting of Tea Party groups will lead to answers. Daines spoke Tuesday evening to leaders of the Big Sky Tea Party in Helena. The IRS disclosed earlier this month that agents had been singling out groups with Tea Party and Patriots in their applications for tax-exempt status. Daines says that more hearing will be held next week on the matter. He said the goal is to, quote, get the facts and the truth, unquote, and blame the Obama administration for being cagey so far on the topic. The congressman is traveling the state during a congressional recess. The Republican is also focusing on concerns over the 2014 implementation of the federal health care law.
State and federal officials say they are providing $4 million to help restore a flood-damaged railroad servicing central Montana grain farmers. Governor Steve Bullock and Matt Erskine with the U.S. Economic Development Administration announced the money for the Central Montana Railroad today at an event in Lewiston. Portions of the 84-mile line were severely damaged in 2011 when high waters buckled a trestle over the Judith River. That forced farmers in the Denton area to pay more to ship their grain to market by truck. The repairs will be paid for by a $1 million federal grant and a $3 million from the State Departments of Transportation and Commerce.
A Lewis and Clark County Sheriff's deputy performing a welfare check on a man suspected of an arson fire ended up shooting and killing the man during a confrontation. Sheriff Leo Dutton says deputies responded to a house in the East Helena Valley shortly after 6 p.m. yesterday on a request for a welfare check. Dutton says deputies were instructed to use caution with the man who had a warrant for his arrest on an arson charge in Musselshell County. Dutton did not provide details about what led to the shooting. Coroner Mickey Nelson said the man was in his 60s. He did not release his name.
A Missoula man has pleaded guilty to his role in a convenience store robbery that left the clerk with serious head injuries. KECI-TV reports Ika Kamaka pleaded guilty today to conspiracy to commit robbery. Prosecutors say Kamaka served as a scout for the January 8th robbery. Court records say Kamaka, a regular customer, grabbed a drink out of a cooler and took it up to the counter. When he did not have enough money, the clerk bought it for him. After he left, surveillance video shows four other men go in. Two beat him with baseball bats, and they took the cash register. Prosecutors say they used the money to pay rent. Sentencing is set for August. Another man involved in the robbery has been sentenced to 10 years in prison.
A janitor discovered six bales of hay doused with either gasoline or oil stacked against the rear entrance of a Billings middle school. The Billings Gazette reports gas cans were found scattered around the hay bales on the receiving dock at Castle Rock Middle School this morning. Principal Sean Harrington called the police and fire departments. Agents from the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives also were brought in to investigate at the school in the northern part of the city. Harrington says agents swept the school before classes started to make sure the building was safe. Nothing was found. Officials are still investigating.
A 20-year-old Sims man has pleaded guilty to desecrating a Great Falls area cemetery in September 2011. The Great Falls Tribune reports Ryan Wood pleaded guilty Tuesday to a charge filed after vandals knocked over headstones, causing more than $1,500 in damage to the Highland Cemetery, south of Great Falls. Prosecutors recovered DNA evidence collected from two beer cans found at the cemetery and then got a warrant to obtain DNA from Wood. Court records say Wood confessed to committing the vandalism with three other males. The same cemetery has been vandalized in May 2011, when more than 200 headstones were overturned.
Dawson County officials have filed four counts of elder abuse against a woman who worked for Eastern Montana Veterans Home in Glendive. Student Susan Stablefelt was arraigned Tuesday in district court in Glendive. She has not entered a plea. County officials said today she does not yet have an attorney. Charging documents allege that between October 2012 and January 2013, Stablefelt abused four patients. Witnesses say Stablefelt put her knee on one man's arm to hold him down, put her hand across his mouth, and told him to, quote, shut up, end quote. Court records allege she twisted another man's arm behind his back, causing him to fall to his knees. Both men were in a ward for patients with dementia. Stablefelt is also charged with slapping one patient and punching another.
Wheatland County officials say 8-year-old Harlowton boy died in a weekend all-terrain vehicle accident in central Montana. Sheriff Jim Rosenberg says James Welshire died Sunday evening. Deputies say Welshire and two other boys were racing ATVs on private property in the Little Belt Mountains when Welshire crashed. Rosenberg tells the Billings Gazette that Welshire was pronounced dead at the hospital in Harlowton.
National Weather Service forecasters say a slow-moving storm system will bring heavy rain through Saturday morning that could trigger flooding in portions of eastern Montana. The agency said today that flooding potential is highest in areas that suffered wildfires last year. Areas scarred by burns are prone to rapid runoff of rainwater, which can exacerbate flash flooding and send dangerous debris into waterways. More than 3 inches of rain are forecast through tomorrow night for parts of the region. 2 years ago, record floods in central and eastern Montana damaged hundreds of homes, prompted widespread evacuations, and triggered an ExxonMobil Corporation pipeline break that spilled 63,000 gallons of crude oil into the Yellowstone River.
It took a contest from a company out of Maine and a social media effort spanning across international borders for Glacier Institute to get an alternative energy project installed on their off-grid campus. The Institute is a nonprofit organization that offers educational opportunities for students and adults in and around Glacier National Park. Katrin Fry reports the Institute plans to have its alternative energy project be both functional and educational.
Executive Director Joyce Baltz says the Glacier Institute offers classes on a wide range of subjects.
So everything from wildlife to geology, flora and fauna, Native American, we teach to the themes of Glacier.
The Institute offers classes at a site within Glacier National Park. It also has a campus at Big Creek on Forest Service land. It's up the North Fork of the Flathead River Valley.
So when you drive up the North Fork Road, you'll notice when you leave the pavement that the power lines end. So about 11 miles later, you'll see Big Creek campground on your right and then the Big Creek Outdoor Education Center on your left.
Balt says having a solar energy element at the Big Creek campus has been on the wish list for a long time.
And we run on a propane generator, and our dream has been for many years to have alternative energy systems to help preserve our propane generator fuel and power.
Last year, the Glacier Institute applied for a nationwide contest sponsored by Toms of Maine. The award program is called 50 States for Good. It chooses one project from each of the states, then opens the contest to the public, who votes via social media for their favorite nonprofit project. Toms of Maine awards one $50,000 grant and five $20,000 grants. Glacier Institute won a $20,000 grant. The Institute teamed up with Sunelco Incorporated out of Hamilton to install the system. It includes solar panels, which will charge up batteries and be used to offset the propane at the Big Creek campus. Balt says Sunelco also added some in-kind donations and installed a wind energy system as well. She says it's a functional system, and they've also built a curriculum around it to teach as part of their educational program.
But the goal was also to be able to teach these energy systems. And we are an authentic teaching site because we are located off the power grid. As far as I know, we're one of the only authentic teaching sites that says what we do and then actually lives by it, that's open to the public.
Balt says this is a first step the Glacier Institute hopes to expand upon in the future. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
An orphan black bear cub that suffered second-degree burns on its paws during an August 2012 fire in eastern Idaho has been returned into the wild, healthy and 70 pounds heavier. Officials with the Snowden Wildlife Sanctuary in McCall say the bear, dubbed Boo Boo, was released into the forests of central Idaho yesterday. Firefighters rescued the then 25-pound cub from a tree during the Mustang fire near Salmon. The bear was initially treated at the Idaho Humane Society before being transferred to Snowden. Boo Boo was among 10 orphan cubs being cared for at Snowden. Snowden's Lori Bagley says Boo Boo left the sanctuary in terrific shape.
And he's been here for the last 9 months where we have been rehabilitating him with plenty of food. And he's been in a two-acre enclosure with 10 other baby bear cubs where he's been able to play and climb trees and just be a little baby bear cub. And he's been growing and He weighed 25 pounds when he came. He weighed 95 pounds when they released him. So that was a really good weight gain for him. In fact, that's more weight than a normal bear for his age.
Boo Boo was released with a GPS collar that will record his location over the next year when it will fall off.
A University of Montana professor appeared today before the annual convention of the American College of Sports Medicine to discuss a study on a remarkable group of cyclists who shattered a previous record by 27 hours. Brett Ruby is the director of the Center for Work Physiology and Exercise Metabolism. Ruby and his colleagues research how people respond to various forms of stresses and how dietary and training strategies can help us better prepare to deal with stress. Ruby's a lifelong athlete who says he's always nurtured a passion for science. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Ruby talks about four cyclists who broke a national record last year and in the process ended up challenging some conventional assumptions.
I had a graduate student at the time whose name is Nate Keck, who's now here in Indianapolis as a cycling coach for Marion University. And he approached me with the idea of a study that he thought would be unique with this four-man team doing the race across America. And that's all he said, and I wasn't that intrigued by it because it's not that interesting of data to just have four guys racing across the country, somewhat predictable. And then he changed my mind because he said they were all over 70.
How'd they do?
They set the record for that age group, which was astonishing. They finished the race in 6.5 days.
What is their secret? I'm not trying to impugn them. Performance enhancers?
Yeah, I think that their secret was part in their strategy for how they approached each leg of the adventure, because they worked in teams of two. You can only have one rider on the road at a time, but they work in teams of two, and the other two are resting, and each work segment is about an 8-hour window, and so one rider is on the road going at it for about 15 minutes, and then he'll transition or tag off to the next rider, who then puts in a hard 15 minutes, and they go back and forth for 8 hours. And then they switch with the team that's just finished resting for 8 hours, and so then they get a big break, and they're able to eat enough and recover. And I was joking with Nate. I said, man, you must have broke a few RV doors, because that's a lot of in and outs into that camper. So, yeah, they can only have one rider on the road, so it's a very aggressive transition strategy. But that, I think, was a big part of their secret.
Who were these guys? I don't mean names necessarily, but is this all they do? Are they retirees? What?
They're retirees, but they grew up racing and very active, and I don't know a lot about them except that they have an uncanny ability to race pretty fast for very long distances.
How did you investigate them?
So this was a descriptive study, so all we were interested in is we didn't want to disrupt their flow or their race whatsoever, because this is a pretty extensive training strategy and a lot of money is involved with the training and the preparation and the actual race itself. So we've done these kind of studies a lot with other racers and other military folks and wildland firefighters, where we can kind of swoop in and give a couple of stable isotopes in a water solution that they just consume. And if we couple those measurements with measures of body weight periodically throughout the event, we can actually quantify how much water is leaving the body and coming back into the body every 24 hours or for the course of this whole event. And we can also calculate very accurately their energy demands, which is how many calories they've expended each 24-hour window over the course of the whole event.
Stable isotopes, what does that mean?
Well, stable isotopes are naturally occurring. They're present in the body and they're present in the water that we consume, just in very small amounts. One's an isotope of hydrogen, one's an isotope of oxygen, and they're just coupled together in a water solution. But they're different than the bulk of the hydrogen and the oxygen components within the body. And so because they're different, we can track them uniquely by looking at ratios of those particular isotopes and the natural occurring oxygen and hydrogen within the body.
So
we just track it by taking samples that they're going to get rid of anyways, and that's in the urine.
Huh. So what'd you find out about these guys?
Well, we've seen big numbers in a lot of our human studies, but we've never studied subjects in that age category. And this is a very aggressive ride, and we thought that we'd see big numbers, but the numbers ranged from about 5,000 calories up to about 7,500 calories every 24 hours. That is an enormous number for an average, young, healthy, very active person. When you consider the age of these guys, I mean, most of the U.S. population sort of checks off older athletes as just older guys that like to be physically active. So to see these big of numbers in this age group is just awesome.
What does this then tell us about the limits, or maybe the perceived limits of, I don't know what the word would be, exertion as we age?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think this, I wouldn't say this changes the rule, but when you see numbers like this, these are the highest numbers that have ever been measured in a higher age group like this. And they're double and then some compared to age-matched males that are obviously less active. But it definitely shows that aging is a function of obviously a lot of different factors. But if you make the right choices and if you remain physically active at various levels, I mean, humans are stitched together to do huge things no matter what our age. We're very capable of expending large amounts of energy and turning over large amounts of water in relatively short periods of time. And so these numbers just sort of challenge the concept that as we get older, we have to get less active. That's certainly not the case. And yeah, there are disease states that show up as a function of aging, and some of those are related to aging, but a lot of those ailments begin early in life because of bad choices that humans classically make in this mechanized world. And that is that we just discard our desire or interest in physical activity. And in doing so, we lose a lot of the capabilities that we were put together to use on a daily basis. That's a big part of this conference, is the concept that exercise is medicine. That's a big part of the theme of this conference, and how profound exercise is at defending humans against a lot of disease states that are linked to physical inactivity.
Boy, that is going against the tide of every imaginable trend right now. We're eating more, doing less activity, looking at our computers and TVs more, and getting bigger and slower in the process.
Yep, scary.
So what do we do about it? What's your advice for the typical person who maybe wants to get in better shape and exercise a little more, but it's just having a difficult time getting motivated?
I wish I could help with the motivation, because that seems to be the key. The science is so steadfast and obvious, from animal models to human models, now of all ages. I guess it's never too late to consider physical activity. There's certainly lots of resources around the country and within the Missoula community that can help. And so if you just seek out those resources, it's never too late to start a walking program, which then could lead to this and then to that. And next thing you know, you're on the bike across the country. So who knows?
And you know what's more, when you get up and just, never mind across the country cycling races, just get up, go around the block. Am I wrong, or does it just clear your head out emotionally, make you feel a little better, and gets your heart pumping at the same time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have been at the university since 1994. I've never owned a parking pass, and I ride my bike year-round back and forth to campus. I've accumulated enough commute miles to have ridden across the country 3.5 times just in my commute back and forth to campus. And you're right, that little bit of physical activity, there's no rule on how much you have to do. You can add it up throughout the day, which is probably better than one bout of activity. But just a little bit of physical activity at various times throughout the day will have tremendous impact on so many physical parameters, but then the host of psychological impacts and positive aspects of it are, I don't even think we've tapped the surface of what it's capable of. I think we could get rid of 3/4 of the medications that we use on a regular basis if we just figured out how to integrate physical activity better into our lives.
Brent Ruby is director of the Center for Physiology and Exercise Metabolism at the University of Montana.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide, tonight expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain showers. Lows will be in the mid-30s to lower 40s. Tomorrow calls for more cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain showers. Highs will be around the 60s. For central Montana, tonight expect cloudy skies with a chance of rain. Lows will be around 40 to 45 degrees. Tomorrow calls for more cloudy skies and expect rain showers throughout the day. Highs will peak around 50 to 60 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain. Lows will range between 30 to 40 degrees. Tomorrow calls for more cloudy skies. Rain is possible throughout the day, and highs will peak around 50 to 60 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Margaret Harrigus.
Have you seen the Men in Black movies? Most of us have. They focus on this secret agency whose sole purpose is to rid planet Earth of alien creatures. No one knows about this covert agency. No one knows about the good they do or how they save the planet countless times each day. CPAs are a lot like that. Yes, you heard me right. I said certified public accountants are a lot like a secret organization of professionals who right the world of wrongs and make it a better place to do business. Let me explain. My name is Margaret Harrigus, and I am the Communications Director for the Montana Society of Certified Public Accountants, a professional association for CPAs. We call ourselves MSCPA, and we have nearly 1,700 members around the world. Most of our membership lives and works in Montana, but their work makes them global professionals. Yes, some of them are the folks you visit each winter to get your taxes done, and some of them may be the auditors that you see in your office once a year. But they are also the CFOs of established and emerging companies throughout the state. They are the leaders in the nonprofit world and the backbone of many government agencies at the local, state, and federal levels. They are the educators readying the next generation of professionals to go out and conquer the world. You see, CPAs are the foundation of successful business. They aren't just tax people or auditors. They aren't just CFOs or controllers. And they certainly aren't the bean counters that television and movies have portrayed them to be. They are the people who are fluent in the language of business. CPAs have a long history in Montana. This June, MSCPA is celebrating our 100th anniversary. 100 years of speaking the language of business. 100 years of building Montana's economy and contributing to Montana's development. Like much of Montana history, our story began in Butte in the early 1900s, centered on the interests of the Anaconda Mining Company and William A. Clark. As gold miners moved north and west and homesteaders came to the state in droves, businesses flourished and they needed those CPAs. The accounting profession grew in Great Falls, Billings, and Missoula, and on June 23, 1913, these CPAs joined forces and established the Montana State Society of Public Accountants. Over the past century, the profession has changed drastically. What was once considered a gentleman's occupation has now become productively infiltrated with brilliant women who comprise nearly 50% of the profession. Today's CPA is very well educated. In the mid-90s, a standard was passed that required all accounting students to complete 150 hours of education to be able to sit for the uniform CPA exam. This, in effect, has resulted in graduates who not only have a bachelor's degree, but also a master's degree in the accounting field. But that doesn't make them a CPA. They still have to pass the grueling 4-part uniform CPA exam. They complete examinations in auditing and attestation, regulation, business environment and concepts, and financial accounting and reporting. Their education doesn't stop once they pass this exam. CPAs are the only accounting professionals who are licensed, and they adhere to a strict code of ethics. In order to maintain their license, and more importantly, successfully help their clients and organizations, they must take hours and hours of continuing education classes annually. Each time Congress changes the tax code, CPAs are learning how to apply it and make it work for the businesses they represent. When Sarbanes-Oxley passed, CPAs worked diligently to make sure not only they were in compliance with these new federal regulations, but that the businesses who rely upon them fully understood the implication of the changes. The same thing is going on now with the Affordable Care Act. CPAs are leading the charge to maintain profitability throughout the compliance process. Recently, CPAs nationwide have committed to being a constructive force in the fiscal responsibility debate. Just last week, CPAs from Billings, Helena, Haver, and Missoula were back in D.C. meeting with Senator Baucus and others to discuss the What's at Stake initiative launched by the American Institute of CPAs regarding the federal fiscal responsibility. The accounting profession believes it's imperative that significant action occurs to resolve our deficit dilemma as soon as possible. CPAs have a special expertise in analyzing and reporting financial data, which allows them to be a constructive force in the fiscal responsibility debate. Who better than CPAs to work on behalf of the public interest and to assist policymakers as they strive to make the difficult decisions associated with government's finances? Montana CPAs were extremely active in the recent legislative session. The MSCPA Legislative and State Taxation Committees worked with legislators from across Montana to explain tax issues and the ramifications that different legislation could have on our citizens. Many may find this surprising, but MSCPA strenuously supported tax simplification bills throughout the session, hoping to achieve a tax system that is fair and understandable to the average person. So you see, CPAs really are like the men in black. They work behind the scenes at every level of business in Montana, speaking the language of business and working hard to make Montana businesses more successful, which in turn provides Montana with a thriving economy. Happy anniversary, Montana CPAs. We are proud of you and the work you do.
Margaret Hargis is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sari Jovetic. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.